Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for an hour of, well, what do we do here on Ask Dr. Dawn? We answer your questions about healthcare and science. We discuss topics of interest, healthcare and science in the news. Also lately, lots of health politics. I have two emails, big, very topical right now. Of course, the H1N1 flu is very much in the news. The first one is from Andrea in Virginia. And this was sent a couple of days ago. My daughter is 8 and running a fever of 102, and it's constant even with ibuprofen. She's complaining of her stomach hurting and her chest hurting over her heart. She has a runny nose and has been sneezing, but she usually gets asthma when she gets a normal cold and has to take breathing treatments, but she's not been wheezing this time, which is weird to me. She hasn't been coughing, but she is complaining that her body is hurting. Is this H1N1 or the regular flu, and should I be alarmed? Well, let's start, Andrea, with a couple of qualitative statements. When you hear about H1N1, there's really two levels of identification. And it really probably doesn't matter much for your daughter's case anyway. Influenza is a broad number of diseases. The H1N1 is an influenza A. In medical offices like my own, we have a nasal swab that will distinguish between influenza A and influenza B, but it won't subtype influenza A and tell us for sure that it's H1N1. That's really only being done in people who are hospitalized with very severe illnesses who have a prodrome that resembles influenza, and so we're trying to figure out what the proportion of those that are H1N1 are. So when you see data like a recent article that came up talking about there have been about X number of cases of deaths from H1N1. Those are always cases where there's been a solid identification. It's a viral illness, and the symptoms are nonspecific. Failure to wheeze is great. That's good news, given that H1N1 has a tendency to go to the lungs in asthmatics, but it doesn't prove that that's not it. This one from Enrique in Santa Cruz. I listened to your show that discussed H1N1. I have a son who's 9 years old and gets asthmatic symptoms about 1 to 2 times a year. He usually gets these when he gets a cold. Should I vaccinate or not? Would I be making a serious mistake in not vaccinating? I'm concerned about the mercury levels and any future side effects this vaccine may have. Well, Enrique, I think almost every physician out there would tell you if you have an asthmatic child that the risks of not vaccinating are greater than the risks of vaccinating. The issue of mercury, I want to spend a little bit of time on, because mercury has become an extreme hot button issue for people, and much more so than it needs to be. The amounts of mercury that anyone gets in a mercury preserved vaccine are truly a drop in the bucket. Our bodies are perfectly capable of detoxifying and getting rid of small amounts of mercury. As adults and as an 8-year-old, that function is very well developed. The problem with mercury vaccine is really in infants. When we give multiple vaccines at the 6-month visit or the 15-month visit, we may be exceeding the detoxification threshold for that very small body weight person, and that may put them at risk. And I'm emphasizing may, because this is only hypothetical. There was a lot about mercury and autism in the MMR vaccines a few years ago. And that is pretty much a discredited hypothesis as far as, oh yes, it was the mercury in the MMR that has caused autism. And alas, the mercury is not in the MMR anymore. And we're still seeing cases of autism showing up at about 15 months, because that's when the autistic child diverges developmentally. And it's a horrible, sad disease. And it is probably related to a combination of environment and heredity. And it is something that we need to be studying, but it's not simple. And it's not, oh yeah, the vaccine did it. Would that it was such a simple explanation. I'd kind of like that. So I want to urge people to try to look it into perspective. You don't get to teleport yourself into a world where there is no H1N1. That menace and the epidemic waves that run through herd phenomenon, herds, like big herds of humans like we have in cities and schools, those are environmental factors that are fixed and are going to happen. That's your risk of not doing something. Your risk of doing something is the theoretical possibility that maybe there'll be a very rare reaction to the vaccine. And I have to come down on the side of, you know, the devil you know is a big devil. And I think I will go with saving myself from the potential serious infections, particularly children and pregnant women. We're seeing lots of deaths, way more than we expect to see. So this is a disease that particularly targets those two groups. And those are groups that have a long lifespan if nothing goes wrong. So we really should be vaccinating those groups. And on the subject of foregoing vaccination, I have to tell you, I got a real laugh this morning over a clipping from the San Jose Mercury News, although it's coming from the LA Times. Media commentators Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh have gone on public saying, we're not going to get vaccinated. It's a left-wing conspiracy. The government, we're not going to do anything the government tells us to do. And I was listening to Politically Correct last night, and Bill Maher basically said the same thing. And I have never in my life expected to see Rush Limbaugh and Bill Maher agree upon anything, including the theory of gravity. So I was very amused to hear about that. And, you know, do you want to be on the side of Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck on the vaccine issue? I sure don't. And Bill, I'm sorry, but I got to go against you on this one. I have a really useful article that just came out. This was a analysis of probiotics for the prevention of traveler's diarrhea, and it was extremely favorable. A meta-analysis is a study where a lot of other studies are put together in order to increase the statistical power. Meta-analyses are very, very difficult to do well, and I think this is a very good one. But it is important to understand that sometimes with events that occur randomly or rarely, you need very large numbers to be able to see a difference, and this is one of those situations. The conclusion of the study was that the probiotics Saccharomyces boulardii, Lactobacillus acidophilus, and Bifidobacterium bifidin, particularly in combination, had significant protection if you take them for a traveler's diarrhea. And I was put onto this by Galen in Salinas, a very appropriately named person who obviously follows his science. So thank you, Galen, for bringing this study to my attention. So Galen wrote, 15 years ago, I went to a Spanish language school in Mexico, and they recommended we bring acidophilus tablets to take with each meal. I did, and they seemed to be effective, although you know it's hard to do a control on yourself. I traveled a lot to Mexico, about 10 times last year in out-of-the-way places and in other Latin American countries. And when I have remembered to take the tablets before eating, I have never gotten sick. And on some occasions, when I have forgotten them, I have gotten sick. I do not have a strong resistance to traveler's diarrhea. On one of my last trips to Mexico, I was eating in a somewhat questionable restaurant. I rate restaurants as either a 1 or a 2 tablet restaurant. This was definitely a 2 tablet restaurant with a Mexican. We ate the same thing except for the meat item. He got sick. I did not. Recently, I saw this article, and I wondered if you would give me your comments. And that was the article I just talked to you about. And basically, what I would say further about this is that I am finding probiotics helpful in a large number of illnesses, allergies, asthma, any kind of bowel disorder that involves cramping or alternating diarrhea or constipation, the so-called irritable bowel syndromes. But not every on-the-shelf probiotic seems to work. A lot of it may be dosing, and certainly there's no official quality control or policing. So I would recommend looking at the interview that we did about a year ago with Bruce Huffnagel, and you'll certainly find that not hard to find in the archives at AskDrDon.com. So take a look at that if you're interested in more on probiotics. So I'm going to do another story. Oh, I like this one. I'm reading Sinclair Lewis's The Jungle, which was a book written about the turn of the previous century about meat safety. You can't read the first couple of chapters of The Jungle and want to go eat meat, and you especially don't want to eat hamburger. And supposedly we got all that fixed after Upton Sinclair's book, The Jungle, came out. But you know what? I'm not so sure. This article from the Sunday Mercury News talks about a recent hamburger recall. This is the E. coli 0157. That's the nasty one that contaminated the spinach a few years ago. And one of the things about these bugs is that they get into meat from fecal contamination on the hide. So if a slaughterhouse is being run really well, that should never happen. But it is an issue because people mess up, mistakes happen. And the way that you prevent those occasional mistakes from becoming massive distribution issues is you test all of your meat. But even now in this country, the meat is not being properly tested. Hamburgers are made from a mixture of trimmings and mash-like product of scraps. We don't want to go too much into this. And some of the stuff comes from the United States and some of it comes from Uruguay. In a recent outbreak in Cargill had a practice of combining these materials, and these things are not being properly tested. Cargill says, oh, well, it's up to our suppliers to check on the bacteria, and it does its own testing only when the ingredients are ground together, which means diluted down to the point where it may not be detectable. The U.S. Department of Agriculture allows grinders to devise their own safety plans and encourages them to test, but does not require it. So, if you want hamburger, folks, given that we don't have good oversight here and that you can die from eating this stuff, I'm recommending buy the meat and have it ground for you rather than getting it mixed together. Now, we have Bruce in Elkhorn. Hello, Bruce. Thank you for the call.
Thank you, Dr. Don. I would briefly mention that even with things like tainted meat, the FDA has no ability to force a recall, as with the salmonella problem with the peanut butter. So it's up to the manufacturer to decide whether they really want to pull a product off the market, even if they know it's contaminated.
Yeah, and I'm really sure that the corporate hearts and minds are totally dedicated to our well-being.
Yes, but it was probably more about the virus. I have asthma, and my understanding was that with the flu vaccine, that it was better to take the second batch, that the initial one that's an inhaler-based is not good for somebody with an asthmatic condition.
That's right. If you have asthma, you shouldn't do the nasal spray, because whenever we use that nasal flu, we see exacerbations in asthma in all of the flus that we've had since the nasal spray has been around. It's been advised not to be used for asthmatics.
The other thing was I had whooping cough or pertussis, whatever, last year, and I was surprised to find out that 2 years earlier the CDC had come out with a recommendation of adults getting their boosters for the DTP and other shots.
Yeah, Boostrix or Adacel are the commercial names for that. And I'm trying to catch everyone as they come through for their physicals, but revaccinating the entire adult population of the United States is a huge task.
So is that why doctors, because I had to find it myself doing research, but it was like whatever I should be getting, whether it's a pneumonia shot or et cetera, you know, past the age of 50, they say you should get a pneumonia or something, but it's the medical profession
65.
Not really encouraging people to get vaccinated.
Well, no, we are. We're trying. You know, we've got an awful lot on our plate right now. You know, I'm supposed to see 3 to 4 patients an hour. I'm supposed to keep track of all their health maintenance, answer their questions, do preventative medicine, and chart.
You know, doctor, it seems like somebody in the office could say, hey, you know, you're due for your tetanus. It's been 10 years.
Except that you didn't get the tetanus from me, and I don't have any documentation of where and when you got it. It's not a simple task, and maybe after 20 years or so of a good coordinated electronic medical record will actually be able to be proactive like that.
And so it'd be better just to go to the CDC and try to see what you need to be inoculated against?
You know, your best bet is to just kind of go in and say, I think I want to bring my vaccinations up to date. And you could do that at the time of your physical, and that means that you should bring in any information you've got. Don't assume that the emergency room told your doctor 5 years ago when you got stitched up for your laceration that they gave you a tetanus shot.
I mean, like the DTP, where they're recommending adults get that.
So you would say, I think I need that. And the doctor would say, yeah, you're right, you do. And you get it. You can be proactive on it.
I guess I'm looking at where do you get that information other than stumbling across
the CDC
it.
Has vaccination recommendations for adults. They're right up there.
They always get the ones that are recommended for country, but not like obviously in the U.S. you need the DTP, whether you stay in town or go out overseas.
It's just go to the website, or you can look at the American Preventative Health Task Force. It's all there. The information's not hard to find.
American Preventative.
U.S. Preventative Health Task Force.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. Let's go now to our next caller, and that would be Jay, who's been patiently waiting. Hello, Jay.
Dr. Dawn.
Hi.
I have my daughter was born at 30 weeks. And, I do want to say I'm happy to be a contributor to KUSP.
Thank you.
So my daughter is a preemie, And my husband and I have decided we would like to give her the H1N1 vaccine.
How old is she now?
She is now 9 months actual, about 6 and a half corrected.
Okay, go ahead.
As I understand it, the rest of us around her should also be vaccinated.
That's probably more important, actually, because she's not going to be handling money. She's not going to be touching doorknobs. She's essentially at the mercy of whoever comes and coughs in her face, which, you know, primarily is mom, dad, and siblings.
Right.
So those are the people who I would target initially with vaccination. And I think that's how you really protect her. She should get the H1N1. Don't get me wrong here. I think this is a baby I would recommend vaccination. But her immune system is not completely developed. So even with the vaccine, she's going to have trouble fighting off the virus. And so having her not be exposed to it is the absolute best way to protect her.
There will be two times during the winter that we're going to have to fly with her. Do you have any other recommendations we can maybe employ to help protect her? We're also going to be getting the RSV vaccine for her.
Okay. Well, the key thing with flying is the scrubbers in airplanes are actually pretty good. So I would definitely understand that as the air recirculates, the major reason we get more sick is not that we breathe in contaminated air. It's that the air is very dry because the scrubbers also take out the moisture. And that dryness really messes with our own immunity. We need wet mucus in our nose to fend off a virus. It's kind of like floating above the surface of the skin, and it can't get to its attachment point. But if that mucus dries up, then the virus can actually settle and get its hooks into your cells and enter the cell. So rinsing out your nose frequently with salt water or using a salt water gel in your nose and just inserting it, those are two fairly useful things. And this is hand sterilizer city. I mean, think about it. You get on the airplane. Okay, you go up and you've got a baby in your arms, so you're going to be using the banister because you don't want to fall. All right, you've just touched a surface that's been touched by 5,000 people today. And then think, what are the odds that there's virus on that banister? Pretty much 100%. Then you walk into the airplane, you put your stuff in the overhead, touching another handle that's been touched by hundreds of people. Then you sit down, you put your hands on the armrests, again, hundreds of people, masking your seatbelt, hundreds of people. Then they come by, well, they used to come by and bring you peanuts. Of course, now your hands are completely covered with virus and you're going to drop down the tray table, also touched by hundreds of people. And then you're going to put stuff in your mouth with your fingers. So this is why we get sick on airplanes. So as your parents, a couple of precautions, use the hand sterilizer after you've gotten everything distributed, then sterilize your hands. I even use the hand sterilizer on the armrests and on anything I'm going to be touching for the rest of the flight, because I know I'm going to forget and touch my face after I fasten my seatbelt. So I look like I've got OCD majorly when I get on an airplane, and I don't care. Fine, you know, I'll never see you again. Go ahead and laugh. And then the other thing with a baby, I would bring a mask, like an N95 mask, and I would keep it in a plastic baggie, a new mask. And if you end up seated next to a person who's coughing or sneezing, you ask the stewardess to relocate you. And if you can't be relocated, make a fuss. You've got a baby, you've got a special needs child. If the baby gets sick, they'll be hearing from your lawyer. And they'll find a place for you.
Mm-hmm.
And worse comes to worse, you're sick, you're wearing a mask. You start coughing or sneezing, or your nose starts running, you put the mask on because you're caring for a vulnerable child. And it really doesn't matter whether it's H1N1 or seasonal flu or para-influenza. You know, a young baby, a particularly preemie, has challenges that really mean that you have to protect them.
Do you recommend the nasal application versus the shot for her, or vice versa?
Oh, she would be a shot. She would be a shot. The nasal application isn't for infants.
Okay.
Okay?
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I was struck by a call that just came in where an off-air caller had some advice for the family with the preemie and essentially said, you know, maybe you could try not to fly during those weeks of the holidays, because that's when, of course, most of the virus is out there, because people who shouldn't be flying are, because they have to be home for Thanksgiving or they need to, you know, be home for Christmas. So those are definitely not good times to fly. And if you can forgo that and maybe make people come to you, Think about that as an option. There's still time to arrange that. Without further ado, let's go to Sarah in Live Oak. Hello, Sarah. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you. First of all, I'm going to be one of those 10 to subscribe at $10 a month.
Thank you.
Because I've saved more than $10 on my copay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And also, I got my flu shot, and I'm going to go and get my H1N1 flu shot. I'm 67, and I get excellent care at my HMO, Santa Cruz Women's Health Center.
Excellent. Good to hear.
And I'm so grateful for them. I've been suffering from dizziness, unbalance, waking up, sitting up, the room just starts spinning. My mother had the same thing. I remember her, it would come and go, and I would get so tired of, you know, how tired you get of when you're taking care of someone and they get sick and you're just like, oh.
Yeah, I know. And it's dizzy as it sort of brings back 18th century Jane Austen heroines with tight corsets and vapors, you know.
Diapers?
Vapors, V-A-P-O-R-S. It's like when you get faint and dizzy and
Yeah.
Like Nell on the railroad tracks and Dudley Do-Right, you know, that kind of thing.
I never thought they felt as sick as I feel when I get dizzy. I mean, you think when you see people get dizzy on TV, you'd think, oh, they just get dizzy and fall down. They
no,
faint.
It's car sick. It's motion sickness.
Terrible sickness.
Yeah, if you've ever had motion sickness, this is what you get with this condition. It's called vertigo. And my guess is that the reason you're getting it now is that you're getting older. Our current understanding of this disease entity is that it's caused by a dysfunction in the inner ear. The characteristics of it are you'll wake up, get up to get out of bed, and suddenly you'll be whirling, or you'll turn over in bed and you'll keep turning. It's as if you floated up and started spinning. It's a false sensation of motion. And when you have your eyes open, it makes you nauseated because when your eyes are open, they're saying, oh, nothing's moving, and your ear is saying, oh, the heck it isn't. And so the brain gets confused and figures you've eaten the wrong mushrooms and tries to make you throw up. It's a protective response, actually, based from the time when we were hunter-gatherers, and or even before that, when we were just animals. We'd eat something, and if it made us sick, we'd throw it up. The reason that the inner ear is sending this false signal of motion is because of a structural flaw. And this does tend to be inherited. Basic structure here, if you can imagine a carpenter's level, you've got the little floating bubble. Well, in the case of the inner ear, it's not a bubble, it's actually little crystals, and they're attached by hairs to a basement membrane. And when you move your head, they're floating in liquid, and the crystals actually move a little bit more slowly than the basement membrane. And that creates a current. Just if you've seen pictures of underwater when the wave comes through and the seaweed moves and it moves so pretty. Mm-hmm. Well, if you can imagine that going on in your ear every time you move your head, mm-hmm. there's a motion and then the little crystals are snapped into place as they're pulled up and then the motion stops until the next wave comes through. But in the case of this condition, some of the little crystals come loose and so they don't stop moving. They become like a snow globe. They've gotten agitated, and now they float around, and as they float around, they hit other rocks, and that stimulates the basement membrane and sends a perception, an illusion of movement. So it's a hallucination of motion, and this has always happened, and there's actually a mechanism in the inner ear. There's a sort of little corner, like a cul-de-sac or a dead end, and eventually the crystals kind of settle in that dead end, and they don't bounce around anymore, but that can take weeks. Recently, there was a doctor who came up with a maneuver, a way of manipulating the head that will force the crystals over into the corner, and a lot of times it's curative or at least very helpful. It's called the Epley maneuver, and I believe that's spelled E-P-L-E-Y, and you can get a description of it online, but it generally needs to be performed by either a family physician who's been trained in it or an ear, nose, and throat doctor.
And I did see the ear, nose, and throat specialist over at in that building besides Dominican.
Oh, and he wanted to get an MRI to make
yes,
sure.
Yes, well, MRI, right
well,
away.
Okay, this is medical politics now. We're going to jump to medical politics, okay?
Yeah,
you ready?
That's the reason I'm calling, because
I'll make you dizzy. Don't hold on, because we're going to jump to medical politics now. 99.9% of the time, what you're going to have is what I just described. 1 in 1,000, you might have an acoustic neuroma, which is a benign tumor of the 8th cranial nerve. Now, if I'm a specialist, and I don't order the MRI, and you have the 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 10,000, whatever the number is,
yeah,
cancer, then legally I gave you the cancer, mm-hmm. because I missed it. So it's complete and total medical CYA. Mm-hmm. In our country, that's what we do. We do the CYA first.
What's CYA?
Cover
your
assets.
Yeah.
So we do that first because doctors are on the block for being blamed for diseases if they don't find the disease when it first walks through the door. In a rational healthcare system, what we would have is we would have guidelines that said, if the person has these symptoms and these findings on exam, then you get the MRI. And if they don't, then you try the Apley maneuvers, and if they get better, you stop worrying about them. Because if they had an acoustic neuroma, they would also have hearing issues, and they would also, more likely than not improve with an Apley maneuver.
Or just give us some form to sign that says, I choose to do the Apley maneuver rather than the MRI.
That would work, except it's not legal, and it wouldn't stand up in court in a tort case. It wouldn't help. So what we need, in fact, I have an article right here from a surgeon named Robert Jackler, who is a professor at Stanford, and he wrote this for the Mercury News, and he basically says, what we need is a national investment in the study of surgical indications conducted by experts and independent of political influence, which would validate this sort of conservative approach and give criteria for when you operate and when you sit tight, and give criteria also for when you order a $3,000 test and when you sit tight. Now, believe me, if 10% of that $3,000 came out of that ear, nose, and throat doctor's income, he would not order an MRI for everyone who came in with dizziness. And I'm not advocating that we create a financial stake that, you know, we penalize the doctors for ordering necessary tests. I think that would be a really bad idea. But I do think that we need to protect the doctors from the consequences of not ordering unnecessary tests, because that's the situation we have right now. So I think it would be completely reasonable for you to go back and say, I'd like to try the Apley maneuver before I get the MRI and see if it makes me better. And if they won't do that, then find yourself another doctor. You can come up to our office and see Dr. Ye, who's one of my associates. He's really good at the Epley maneuver.
What is his specialty?
He's family practice.
But Dr. Ye, Y-E-A?
Yeah, he's just really good at it. I'm not very good at it, so I send my patients to him, and he gets them better.
Oh, thank you, yeah.
There's lots of variation in talent, right? Some people sew better, some people sing better, some people do the Epley maneuver better.
Yeah.
Okay.
Some people talk on the radio better and help us all out. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you. We had a caller wanting to know if calcium should be taken in the evening because it's not absorbed as well in the morning. And Samantha and Marina, the answer to that is most people have a hard time getting the calcium into their mouth at all. Take it when you will take it, and you can't take more than 500 milligrams at once because you won't absorb it. My recommendation is put it where your food is and take it when you eat, and take a chewable form because that way you have stimulated stomach acid by the food and you've also chewed it up, so they're more likely to absorb more of the calcium. And also get your vitamin D levels checked and make sure they're at least 35, because you won't be absorbing the calcium if your vitamin D levels are below that. I have to say about half the time the vitamin D levels are low. We have time for one quick caller, Melinda in San Jose. Hello, Melinda.
I have a question about all this news about the concussions and late life trauma. And I had a bad concussion in my early 20s. I was in a car accident. I was unconscious for, I believe, about a half an hour, and I had amnesia for about a week after that. I'm in my late 60s now. So, and the other thing is my mom had a very similar experience when she was young. She said her concussion was so bad they thought she was dead. And my mom had developed non-Alzheimer's dementia at a relatively early age. Nobody else in the family has had that.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess my concern is, because they're saying it doesn't show up on CT scans and MRIs, if I have any risk because of this.
Yes, you do. Anyone who's had a concussion that was bad enough to cause amnesia, either forward or backwards, has micro trauma to the brain. They have swelling and they have ripped little bits of brain cells. They've ripped them up, torn them, in other words. They don't show on a scan. It's too microscopic. But
now I'm scared.
Well, you know, you're going to die, too. I mean,
I know.
So, but the point is, what you're scared of is you're scared of becoming disabled and and having a period of dementia. And you have a higher risk of that because of your head trauma. And it's not something that is directly reversible. It's not something we can operate on. What you can do is you cannot smoke, you cannot drink alcohol, you can eat lots of fresh fruits and vegetables, which are antioxidants. You can keep your hsCRP, high sensitivity C-reactive protein level, low. You can take lots of them. We don't have much time, so let me do the list, okay? You can take lots of omega-3 fatty acids, and by lots, I mean 2,000 to 3,000 milligrams of EPA and DHA. And these are all things that independently help slow the progress of the inevitable brain decline that we will all experience. And your timeline may have been moved up by this experience. The things that you can do about it are essentially limit further damage. That's what you can do. I also think you should plan your life according to the idea that you may need some kind of assisted living set up. And as you make financial decisions and personal decisions, don't get yourself living alone up in the hills because you know you really like that location and end up stuck in a cabin on the hills where no one is going to be able to come and get to you, because you may need to be in a more collective household before you die.
What kind of a timeline am I looking at? I mean, I'm
Nobody knows. No, this is unpredictable. It's just you have an extra lottery ticket in a lottery you don't want to win.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.